Yeehaw, everyone, and welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I'm joined tonight for a discussion of our favorite westerns by my favorite cowpoke, JB.
And gather around, youngins, because I have a book here I want to read you. It's called Guntown Marshall by John Robb, Chapter 1. Sean's father unhooked his gun belt from the wall and buckled it round his waist. Then he knotted the leg cord. Sean watched, feeling a flicker of fear. He chanced a question. "What's the matter, Pop?" Herb Brent, Marshal of Glory Rise, gave his son a strained smile. "There could be trouble coming," he said. "Whatever happens, you gotta stay right here."
It gets a lot sexier from there, everyone, so you want to keep listening to the podcast. You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, where you can find all of our past episodes. We have over 100 of them, so make sure you go to fthismovie.blogspot.com to hear every show we've ever recorded. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie, follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. You can find us on DVD Verdict, where you should go for all of your DVD and Blu-ray review needs.
You can find us in the gutter when all the bars have closed.
And DVDVerdictPresents.com. And as always, you can email us suggestions, feedback, recipes, whatever you like, at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
And when the excitement starts to lag tonight, I will be reading further from Guntown Marshall by John Robb.
There's something alarming about the fact that the first word in the book is Sean. I don't associate the name Sean with a cowboy. Hey, everyone, I'm Cowboy Sean.
Well, I think it's interesting that, A, you have never spent any appreciable time in the Old West, so you're talking out of your old Western ass, and Sean is the son, and could I argue that they're deliberately using that name to make him weak and feminine, sure, and not up to his father, who, of course, is Herb.
Cowboy Herb.
And it's quite odd that Herb would be the deputy. I'm not familiar with a lot of deputy Herbs.
I can't wait to find out where this goes. Before we talk about our favorite westerns,
although
JB,
Deputy Herb,
yeah,
isn't that what Doug used to call his weed?
Only after he deputized it. JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Why, yes. In keeping with the theme of tonight's show, a week or two ago at the fantastic Portage Theater, which looks like it might be out of the, whatever that expression is. For those of you who don't live in Chicago or don't care, the venerable Portage Theater was in danger of being bought and turned into something else that's not a theater. And I would argue that there's plenty of open spaces in that neighborhood for anything that wants to move in, but we got to protect our theaters. And it's very close to being named a historic site, which would protect it and keep people from changing it appreciably. And it looks like it's going to stay the Portage Theater. So go Alderman John Arena, who seems to be spearheading this drive. And I was there a week or two ago for the Northwest Chicago Film Society screening of Man of the West.
Yes.
This is one of those Anthony Mann westerns, and I had never seen it. And it starred Gary Cooper, who then was at the end of his career. And again, like most movies from that era, amazing actors show up in supporting roles, and you're like, oh my God, it's, and there's Arthur O'Connell, and there's Lee J. Cobb, and there's Jack Lord from Hawaii Five-0, is sort of a minor bad guy, who not only gets beaten up, but Gary Cooper strips him of his clothes to humiliate him because he's done something awful earlier. I had never seen it. They were showing it. Oh, the print was beautiful. It was this beautiful color CinemaScope print, and it was amazing. Although the effect of the film, did I talk to you about this?
I don't think so.
Two older men found their way into the screening.
Okay.
And several people I've told the story to have suggested that they were homeless. They did have a lot of things with them, more things than you would take to a theater. It was a pretty chilly night, so maybe they just thought, we'll get in out of the cold. They proceeded to talk so loudly about the film, and they had booming bass voices. So twice I got up and found another seat, and I could still hear them. And then apparently it was dinner time, so they began to noisily eat.
Wait, I know who these two guys are. They're film critics. They write for bumsonfilm.com. two homeless men.
Yeah, and movies. I don't want to be unkind, but the loud talking was followed by loud eating, and then, and this was the greatest thing of all,
loud pooping.
No, that would have been worse. I'll admit that would have been worse. About a half hour before the film ended, one of them fell asleep.
Oh.
And started to loudly snore.
Oh my gosh.
So loud that his companion got up and changed seats. Suddenly they weren't sitting next to each other, and it's like, well, you know Billy Bob. He's pretty loud. So that's a testament to how great the movie was, that didn't spoil it.
Yeah.
Because I don't like bad audience behavior. if you ever get a chance to see Man of the West, it's so surprised me, because there's films in the canon, there's films in the pantheon, there's films that you say, well, there's this, and then this is a little bit less known. I saw American Reunion.
Yeah, you did.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, if you guys want to hear at least my thoughts on American Reunion, there's a podcast on it, which you can find at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Now, you really loved American Reunion, correct? I know I'm on record as disliking it, but you said it was one of the best movies you've seen this year?
No, I don't know who you were talking to.
Am I confusing
but
this?
But they were.
Oh, you know who loved it? Bums on Film. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm so constantly confusing you.
Patrick
with
so
bums
often
on film.
Makes that mistake of me and a bum. I would have to say that I might have hated it more than you, in that I think I have less residual goodwill towards the characters, which, judging from the podcast, you and Doug obviously have a little residual love of the characters. Although, as you mentioned in your podcast on the original film, American Pie is by no means
great.
No, it was sort of this social sensation. It was sort of the Porky's of your generation.
Right.
But Porky's isn't a very good movie either.
Isn't that weird?
And it's by the guy who directed
Black Christmas. Children shouldn't play with dead things.
A Christmas Story.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say, you know, Bob Clark's one good film. And finally, Chinatown came out on Blu-ray, and you had a wonderful review of that
Thank
on DVDverdict.com, where you pointed out that all the extras were just ported over, but the Blu-ray does look better. I think every couple of years you should watch Chinatown and just marvel at what movies used to be. In fact, annoying tangent?
Yeah, please.
What year did Chinatown come out?
74?
Okay.
73?
I'm 12.
Okay.
And one day, my cousin, who was probably early 20s, stops at my house to visit my mom, and they sit down and have coffee, and she's just seen it. And she's over the moon about how much she liked it. And for the next, I remember this like it happened yesterday, for the next half hour, she told my mother the entire plot. Which was probably a good idea, because last Christmas, I took my mom to the movies. Let's go to the movies. This will be fun for mom. My mom is getting on in years. And I took her to see Little Fockers, which she loved. She loved the hell out of it. And driving home, at first I thought she was making a joke. The last movie she saw in a theater before Little Fockers was The Sting.
Wow.
So maybe it was good that my cousin was telling her the plot of the Chinatown, because there's no way she's going to see it on her own. But for some reason, even at 12, I thought, sitting someone down and telling them the plot of a movie for half an hour is sort of bizarre.
Right.
Although, looking back, I think what she was responding to is, the first time you watch Chinatown, it's sort of baffling as it goes on.
Right.
I mean, it really gives you credit for being able to put things together. And it does tie up so neatly at the end that I think your feeling the first time you see it is, as you're leaving the theater, you realize how clever it was.
Right.
So I think she was in that euphoria.
Right.
But I still remember my cousin relating the entire plot of Chinatown to my mother in a little suburban house in Arlington Heights, Illinois, It was a simpler time. 1974.
I just rewatched it, like you said, and it was maybe the third time I had seen it, and I think the first time I saw it, I was probably at an age where I couldn't really appreciate it. Second time it was a little better, and this time it was not like watching it the first time, but I really was kind of blown away at how good it is.
I think we might have moved past this in Hollywood, but there was a long period of time where screenwriters who you would respect held that up as the single best original screenplay ever written.
Interesting. Do you think there's a one that has replaced it?
No, I think... this is hard to put into words. Give me a second. I don't think anything's replaced it. I think the bar has been lowered to where someone who had just started screenwriting, like in the last couple of years, might think, oh, well, that's good, pointing to something kind of stupid and ephemeral.
Sure.
Maybe because it spawned sequels or because it made a lot of money. But as far as I know, Chinatown made a lot of money and completes the trifecta of amazing but batshit Faye Dunaway performances. Bonnie and Clyde, Network, and Chinatown.
You're leaving out Supergirl.
I've never seen Supergirl.
That take away the amazing part and just leave the batshit, and that's Supergirl. Or Mommy Dearest. Same thing applies.
Okay. Mommy Dearest, when the podcast is over, I will tell you the Mommy Dearest story. Okay. I'd rather have not have that immortalized. But
all right.
I would say all three of those performances work.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're really, really good performances.
Yeah.
But they're quite a thing. They are very aware of being performances.
Sure.
Which is interesting because on the other side of the screen you have Jack Nicholson giving what I think is
his best. I don't know. I might consider it his best, partially because I think it's one of his least Jack Nicholson performances.
Well, see, that I think is the problem. Well, first of all, he's given great dialogue.
Sure.
The dialogue that he has in that movie is great. The line that you always hear, because I almost lost my nose, and I like it. My theory on Jack Nicholson is The Shining, as much as I like the performance in The Shining, taught him a very bad lesson that was only emphasized or encouraged in further movies, especially the Tim Burton Batman. And we're at a point now where he's not giving a performance.
Right.
It's something,
right.
Call it what you want. This is something we need for the F This Movie glossary. By the way, if you haven't clicked, it's on the main page, and it says F This Movie Glossary, and you should read it because it's entertaining. And I noticed you did update it. You added those other two.
I may have, yeah.
Yeah, you did, which was delightful.
Woo-hoo.
But that's what I've seen lately, and I'm waiting for better films in movie theaters that aren't 20 miles from my house.
My goodness, are they coming out? I've seen mostly garbage, and partially because I've been so busy watching stuff for other things, whether it's podcasts or reviews or whatever, so I'm running low on time to actually watch things that I want to watch. But I saw two movies that I'll talk about very quickly. The first was a documentary that I watched on Netflix Instant called, and I might get the title wrong, Papatopoulos. It's a documentary about the filmmaker Jim Wynorski, who makes a lot of movies. All of them pretty terrible. He's sort of the Ed Wood, Roger Corman school of directing, where he sort of makes schlock and is happy to do that.
He's one of the direct-to-video kings.
Oh my gosh. They actually say in the documentary that one of the cable networks, maybe HBO, because he's made something like 80 movies in 20 years. HBO maybe came to him and they were so tired of every movie that they were showing, saying directed by Jim Wynorski, that they asked him to use a pseudonym. And he's got about 12 different pseudonyms that he uses. So you could be watching a Jim Wynorski movie and not even know it. It was kind of interesting, especially as a comparison to Corman's World, which I know you also just watched.
Which I just saw and found really disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed watching it just because I like seeing all the clips from his movies, but I didn't think the movie really had anything to offer.
No.
It was all stuff that we already knew.
And I had great expectations because Jack Nicholson they finally sat him down
yeah.
to talk about that. And I'm not sure if it's in the doc. I'm guessing it has to be because it's the highlight of the whole thing. But there's a special feature on the disc with extra interviews that yeah. got trimmed. The scene where he chokes up, is that in the documentary itself?
I don't believe so.
Okay. The filmmakers had this idea where at the end of every interview they did, they asked the interviewee to look at the camera as if it were Roger, and what message would you give to Roger? And you can see why they took it out, because it doesn't work at all, except Nicholson. Nicholson looks right at the camera and says, "Roger, I don't know if I've ever told you this before," and he chokes up. He starts to sob, and he can't get anything else out. But what he's trying to say, and I think eventually in a halting fashion he does say, is that he would not have a career
yeah.
if it wasn't for Corman, and that Nicholson owes every ounce of success he's had to Corman. And if anything, it shows you how wrong-headed the filmmakers are, because even if this trope of look at the camera and pretend it's Roger doesn't work, you're telling me you couldn't find a place in the film for
right.
that?
Right.
The reason I bought it was to hear what Nicholson said about Corman. Yeah. My God! Yeah.
It's. I mean, they found a lot of the big names that sort of started under Roger Corman, but it's basically just those six people interviewed over and over again.
Yeah.
The Jim Wynorski documentary, I don't think it totally works. I'm not suggesting that people watch it unless you're a fan of his terrible movies. The central conceit is he's out trying to shoot a movie called The Witches of Brestwick. In 3 days with a crew of, I think, two people and like four actors. And the part that confuses me about the thing is, like, you know, we talked about this on the Plan 9 podcast, or I think it's evident when you watch even Corman's World. Roger Corman is a cheap guy and he's a businessman. But at one point in his career, he did make art. He does love movies. Ed Wood loved movies so much, he just didn't know how to make them. But you could still tell that he loved making movies. A few people in this Wynorski documentary talk about how much he loves making movies, but that never comes across. It's this weird mercenary. It's not even like a business thing for him, because it doesn't seem like he's making that much money. It's just, it's almost like a numbers game.
It comes across as a curious form of OCD. Like, he can't stop.
Right. And it's just to see how many he can make and how cheap and quickly he can put them out. I don't know. But it was kind of interesting. I might say I liked it better than Corman's World. The other movie I watched, I was actually going to write a column on. We do this sort of barely recurring new column called I'll Watch Anything. And I was going to write about it, but I'm not going to, because it would just be too difficult. But I finally watched the Frank Miller directed The Spirit, which came out a couple years ago and is very, very terrible. I have not read the comic. I know of it just from reading, like, the 10-Cent Plague or whatever, that book that came out a couple years ago, but I've never read the Will Eisner comic. I have a feeling, and I could be wrong, that Frank Miller hasn't either. I don't know. It's well photographed, because the DP is Bill Pope, and he's very good, and Frank Miller knows how to sort of compose a static image, because that's what he did in comic books. The writing is some of the worst you've ever heard. It's almost fascinating to watch, because every actor in the movie is openly miserable and almost deliberately. Samuel Jackson and Scarlett Johansson seem to deliberately be giving the worst performance they possibly can.
It's a mess, and I hardly remember it, because I did see it when it came out, and I think I was influenced by the fact that I think I was about 15, went through a major Spirit phase, where I read every Spirit back issue I could get my hands on, because Will Eisner, just visually, he was a genius. And that is a real interesting comic book, because he did that and as sort of an independent contractor, and it became this thing that they added to newspapers,
right,
that he did it and he was his own boss, but it was distributed in local newspapers. The original Spirit comics are amazing, and just the melding of superheroes and film noir.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, the movie's a mess.
And he just seems to borrow the aesthetic from Sin City,
because
it worked once, so why not do it again? It really isn't good. It kind of reminded me of Maximum Overdrive, in that, like, maybe not all writers should direct, but whatever. The Spirit's a mess.
Well, my final comment on The Spirit after I saw it was that Robert Rodriguez quit the Directors Guild because they would not let him co-bill Frank Miller as the director of Sin City. And then after seeing The Spirit, I was like, Robert, maybe you were a little hasty in doing that. And I have a lot of respect for Frank Miller just because of his Batman stuff. But as you said...
Well, and he's just gone completely batshit crazy in the years since, if you know anything about Frank Miller. He's a nutjob. Anyway, let's talk about Westerns.
And you have a little piece of paper there?
I do. I wrote some down.
And I have a little piece of paper here.
Good.
And this I have a out. Book oh. called Guntown Marshall, Chapter 2.
When last we left Guntown Marshall, Sean was a pussy.
Fix him easy. The words bit into Sean's brain like drops of acid. They could only mean one thing, that Catsfoot would be taken by surprise. The rest would be simple murder. Outnumbered, he would be helpless, even though he was a top gun.
We talked about doing a show on Westerns for a little while, because Westerns are sorely underrepresented on this movie.
And as my great college professor said, I must take a moment and talk about David Desser, who I'm guessing through no twist of fate has ever heard any of these podcasts. He taught at U of I for years and years and years and years and years. He's like the greatest guy I've ever met. He was something of a mentor at University of Illinois. He taught me most of what I know about film. And there's a lot of Desser quotes floating around in my head. But the one I remember most often is, you cannot claim to love film and hate Westerns.
I won't say that I hate Westerns, but it is one of the genres, along with musicals, that I feel like I've maybe seen the least of.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in the case of Westerns, I sort of understand it's because there are so goddamn many of them. Because for a number of years, that's what Hollywood was cranking out.
And that's something we tend to forget, and I'm always telling my students. For decades, that was the single most popular genre.
Yeah.
While the Universal monster films pretty much single-handedly saved Universal from bankruptcy, when Universal started, its bread and butter were these Westerns. They just made hundreds of them, and they might not have played in the prestigious theaters, but they paid the bills and they kept the lights on. For decades, the single most popular genre was Western. And when television began...
Everything was Western.
For decades after that, it was this trope that has gone. And I often wonder why, although I have a theory, and Westerns are great. It's interesting that you mentioned the musical thing, because I was going to mention the musical thing, because you've mentioned this before. I think part of the problem is, A, there are very few really great musicals.
Yes.
And after a while, the stylization of that can begin to grate on you. But I think what's interesting about Westerns, and I think what's true of people who really love Westerns, is like ballet dancing or tap dancing, you're looking at such... How can I put this? That it's such an established thing that you're dealing with maybe 15 ingredients, and every Western is variation on a theme.
Right.
Because with few dissenters, so to speak, you're watching the same story over and over. And again, because Westerns were so popular for such a long time in movie theaters and on television, we must ask ourselves, why was this a story that we had to see over and over and over? And maybe later on I can suggest why that's the case.
Okay. So we're going to each talk about five of our favorite Westerns, or our five favorite Westerns.
And when we get sick of that, there's Guntown Marshall, because in just a few minutes we'll start Chapter 3, which is subtitled In the Sage.
There are several, before I give my list, there are several Westerns considered to be classics that I have never seen. I've never seen The Magnificent Seven, so that will not appear on my list because I've never seen it.
Have you seen The Seven Samurai?
I have.
Have you seen A Bug's Life?
I have.
Then you've seen The Magnificent
Seven. And Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, yeah.
Always
forget that one.
All remakes of The Magnificent Seven, but I've never actually seen The Magnificent Seven. I saw half of it once because I convinced my high school history teacher to let us watch it because we were learning about feudal Japan. And I said, well, you should let us watch The Magnificent Seven. So I saw half of it, but I don't remember it. Anyway.
One of the things I like the most about Magnificent Seven is that the Yul Brynner character, and Yul Brynner now comes across as so iconic because some of the roles he played. The Yul Brynner character's name is Chris.
That's like Cowboy Sean.
Yeah, very much.
All right, so I'll name my first.
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah, please.
Earlier today, to make sure that I wasn't going goofy, I found some lists of the greatest westerns on the internet, which I believe are a series of western tubes. And I just wanted to see how far outside of the mainstream I was.
Okay.
Are these sort of accepted as westerns and stuff? So in the process of looking at all these lists, I came upon some very goofy lists.
Okay.
That had films on them, the 25 greatest westerns, the 100 greatest westerns. In one case, it was the 500 greatest westerns. I don't have time for this.
Yeah, right.
The goofiest film I found on any list, I had to include this in the podcast. List of top westerns, The Gold Rush.
Wow.
The Charlie Chaplin film.
That's a little bit of a stretch, huh?
Because remember when he takes out a six-gun?
Right.
I'm guessing because they're...
Because it's about
the gold,
the establishment
panning
of,
for gold.
Right, the western United States. And
there are no horses in that film. There's a couple mules.
Right.
That is just...
It's a reach.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And again, I run into the issue of trying to avoid repeating movies that are on JB's list, because actually some of the movies on JB's list are some of my favorite westerns. So here are five other ones. I'm going to go chronologically. So the first one on my list from 1959 is Rio Bravo, which is, I think, of the movies that I chose, sort of the only... I was trying to figure out the ways to describe them. There's like square westerns, and then there's sort of revisionist westerns, and most of those come later. It's the only square western on my list.
Okay, now you got to help me out, because as much as I love westerns, there's a couple films that I always confuse with other films.
Rio Lobo, and there's...
Which is much later.
Yes.
And has Angie Dickinson as Feathers.
No, that's Rio Bravo.
Okay, then I'm completely confused. And Rio Bravo...
Yes.
Besides John Wayne, stars...
Dean Martin, Ricky Nelson.
Okay, I got it. In fact, they just did a restoration, or perhaps it came out on Blu-ray, or
it's out on Blu-ray.
Okay, I think the last time I saw it is when it came out on Blu-ray, and of course it's Howard Hawks.
Right.
Okay.
I feel it's a little long, like it's almost 2.5 hours, and people would argue that all of that is necessary, but I love Howard Hawks. It's become sort of this iconic story, probably because John Carpenter just keeps remaking it over and over again. But it's just this great story of these four guys who have to hold off against an entire town of bad guys, basically protecting a prisoner.
And one of the things I love so much about it is, and I actually marvel at this guy's performances in a lot of movies, Dean Martin is really good in it.
He's what makes the movie for me.
To anyone who ever thought that he was a lightweight or a saloon singer or Jerry Lewis, a straight man, God forbid, he's so good in that movie.
Yeah, he's what makes the movie for me. And actually, when I thought of it, when I was like, oh, Rio Bravo should be on my list, I was picturing Robert Mitchum in that part. And obviously, it's not. But
it's hard to imagine. It's easier to imagine Mitchum playing the John Wayne part.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've heard this, because it's a popular anecdote. Apparently, Howard Hawks made Rio Bravo.
Yeah, this is what I was just going
to
say.
In reaction to High Noon.
Yeah.
Because in his opinion, a lawman doesn't need help from anyone in the town.
Right.
I will do my job. I mean, High Noon really incensed Howard Hawks.
John Wayne as well.
Yeah.
And John Wayne's feeling was that the town shouldn't be turning their back on him, and the fact that they did, he should have just put the girl on the train and left them to fend for themselves because they had turned their back on him. He was disgusted by the actions of the townspeople.
But I wonder, knowing what we know about Wayne's politics, if there's other aspects of High Noon that rubbed him the wrong way.
Right.
But if you're new to westerns, if you decided to dip your toe in the pool, Rio Bravo is just... It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I like High Noon, which is about as square, I think, a western as you can find.
I like your designation of square versus revisionist.
Yeah.
And relating to your comment about the fact that it might be a little long, sometimes I think with certain films, what I call it is downshift. I have to downshift into 50s mode. But this week in film study class, we're in the middle of a unit on the comedy, and I'm showing Some Like It Hot, widely considered by some people to be the greatest comedy ever made.
It's certainly, people that haven't seen American Reunion, go on!
It's certainly considered the number one comedy ever made by the American Film Institute. And sometimes I have to remember that, like a Broadway show, there was a period of time where a movie was an evening's entertainment.
Right.
And theaters had one screen, and there was less interest in getting them in and getting them out because there were other parts of the show, like a cartoon and a short subject, that a lot of times, if it goes over the two-hour mark, well, this is an evening's entertainment.
Right.
This is what people were doing of an evening. Now, you have arranged yours chronologically.
Yes.
And not told me about this concept.
I couldn't really rank them because,
you're going
again,
from old to new?
Yes.
Okay, well, then this is apples and oranges because I ranked them.
That's fine. I just couldn't because some of my movies are on your list, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
No, I what does that mean?
I couldn't rank my favorites because some of my favorites I'm not naming because they're on your list.
And when we get to them, you're going to say,
that would have been on my list? Except I didn't want to double up, that's all.
Is that what you're going to say?
Sure.
Okay, chapter 3. Oil was burning. Then oil and wood were burning. Together, they were sending up billows of black smoke. And in the black smoke, which I'm guessing is the remnants of the moisture farm on fire, I will suggest that one of my favorite westerns is Star Wars. The original Star Wars movie, A New Hope. And this is not just to get under Mike Pomero's skin, but this is a way of introducing the fact that one of the reasons why we don't see Westerns anymore is that they've gone underground, and what we have is disguised Westerns, that they're tricked out and they fool us into thinking they're other genres like science fiction. I've never considered Star Wars science fiction by any definition that I have of what science fiction does.
With the exception of science fiction signifiers being laser guns and spaceships.
Right.
But that is Star Wars' only connection to science fiction. I agree with you.
So, Star Wars introduces us to the mythos of the Western sort of stripped down. And I've often called Star Wars, at least the original trilogy, to be Joseph Campbell on acid. Lucas has acknowledged the influence of Joseph Campbell. In fact, at the end of his life, Bill Moyers did a series of interviews with Joseph Campbell at the Skywalker Ranch, which later became this, oh my God, it's 10 or 12 hours long. It's really incredible. But Joseph Campbell studied myths from all sorts of different cultures and came up with this theory called the Hero of the Thousand Faces, that every different culture's myth is actually the same. It's the same story over and over again. So Star Wars introduces us to a conflict that takes place out on the frontier. In this case, it's the frontier of space. And basically, it's a conflict between two warring interests. There's one group of people who are interested in traditional family structures. They have wives and husbands and children, and they are interested in putting down roots and farming, for the most part, or raising domesticated animals, and or in this case, moisture farming, and they are interested in having stores and churches and schools. And then there's another faction that it really believes in lawlessness. They're nomadic, and they want to roam around everywhere they want to, and they don't like the farmers because they put up fences, and they often dress all in black. And that's what Star Wars is.
Right.
It's just in outer space. And it just it does the Western mythos beat by beat by beat. It's really sort of amazing, including the older mentor figure, including, and here's where I think Lucas loses the Western. In a standard Western, the farmers are up against it because, by definition, they can't be lawless because they believe in the law. They are law-abiding, and they are up against a group of people who will gladly do anything they have to do, including shooting anyone down. So there's always an outsider figure who comes, and he's not a farmer, and he's not a cattleman. He's somewhere in between. And in the Star Wars mythos, that's Han Solo, the lovable rogue who can do what needs to be done for the farmers. But then, almost by definition in the Western, he has to leave. Because by making everything safe for the settlers, he's guaranteed a culture that he cannot be part of.
Right.
And yet, Star Wars revises that,
right,
because at the end, he shows up, he helps Luke, and he's welcomed back into the fold. So that's how that changes. But structurally, I think Star Wars is a Western. And if you want another example of this, Patrick and I were talking about this yesterday, The Road Warrior is even more a Western, just beat by beat by beat. In fact, it sometimes seems like a strange, futuristic Australian remake of Shane.
Mm-hmm. My next movie from 1966 is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which isn't just, I think, one of the best Westerns ever made. It's like one of the best movies ever made. It's what you said about, or what Desser said about Westerns. I feel about specifically The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I don't think you can love movies the way that we do on this podcast, or the way that the people that listen to the podcast do, and really dislike The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You don't have to love it.
Well, I love it, but let me add this to the mix.
Yes.
And I'm thinking specifically of that scene at the end where the three of them square off,
yes,
in the widest frame.
Yes.
If you're not watching in the right aspect ratio, one and sometimes two of them gets chopped off, because I remember watching this on TV when I was, yeah, a kid, that the only way to describe that scene at the end is operatic.
That's the whole movie.
And it's not just the music playing on, right, the soundtrack. I mean, this is...
No, the whole movie is pitched at the level of opera.
But, much like the Beatles-Rolling Stones argument...
Yes.
I would suggest the following. Because, again, earlier today I looked at all these lists.
Yes.
There are people who place The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly above...
Listen... The movie that you're about to mention, I think, is a better movie.
Okay, but you knew it was going to be on my list.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, because...
That, I think, is the best... And it's, sorry to talk around it.
Yeah.
I think the best Western ever made is yet to be talked about.
No, I'm gonna bring it up next.
Okay.
That on some of the lists... And it's interesting that they were always very close.
Yeah.
And they were just sort of changing places. On a lot of lists, it was, this is one, this is two, this is two, this is one.
Right.
Or further down the list, not that it matters. That I've talked to plenty of people who say The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the greatest Western ever made. It is my ringtone.
Yeah.
Very proud of that. Also, very strange when you're watching television, because that's used in some commercials.
Okay.
And I always think my phone is ringing. It happens more than you think. And when it goes off in class, the students just, there's a spaghetti Western in your desk, Mr. Dottery.
No, that's just spaghetti.
I do love my pasta. So there's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is an amazing film. And then there's Once Upon a Time in the West, which, again, on these lists seem to change places. And you're a Rolling Stones person, you're a Beatles person. You're a Good, the Bad, and the Ugly person. You're a Once Upon a Time in the West person. Not that someone who likes one would hate the other.
Right.
But just if a Colt 45 was pressed against your head, hold on, Chapter 5 of Guntown Marshall's coming, and you had to pick one.
Right.
There's people who favor one, and there's people who favor the other. And a couple weeks ago, my son was home from college. He was on spring break, and we spun the Blu-ray, and oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The quote from your former teacher, I think, is interesting, that you cannot love movies and not love the West. I mean, I guess I understand that, but I do think there's plenty of Westerns that I could not love. But I can't imagine somebody that loves movies not loving these two Sergio Leone movies, because they have everything that you want in a movie cranked up to 11.
And I could see someone quibbling, no, not in this one, that Once Upon a Time in the West has a glacial pace. It is very slowly paced.
Yes.
But I really like that. I think that's part of its charm. I think it's a deliberate pace.
Yes.
And I would say, if you were teaching a film class or if you're teaching a filmmaking class, that opening scene at the train station,
mm-hmm,
is one of the best editing workshops you can ever show a young filmmaker.
Yeah.
Think about how little is said. In fact, there's a couple incidental lines of dialogue, maybe from that train station master or something, but... That is shot composition, editing, and music.
Rio Bravo does almost the same thing. The first 10 minutes of Rio Bravo are almost entirely silent. There's some murmurs in the saloon. but where we get to see essentially what this, what the bad guy is being imprisoned for, because he murders a guy, is all told without dialogue. And I thought that was especially interesting because Hawks is so well known for the pacing of his movies and the dialogue, and here he is working without those two things. Whereas Sergio Leone, I think, is more, much more of a visual storyteller than Hawks. But
I don't find it distracting, mainly because I know films were made that way back then in that country, that a lot of the dialogue is looped later on.
Right.
That there were long sequences that he filmed MOS,
right,
and then you would go back because it was just a lot more economical. The last time I watched it with my son, though, what I was really marveling at was how long the reveal is delayed of why Charles Bronson has the harmonica.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, in the hands of any other filmmaker, at least halfway through.
Yeah.
And maybe even earlier. But my God, when we get to that, the payoff is just, boy, I knew Henry Fonda was a son of a bitch, but Jesus.
And how great is that? That Henry Fonda is this great bad guy, just the nicest guy in every movie.
And I can't think that after, I mean, Once Upon a Time in the West is pretty much at the end of his career. He starts making things like The Swarm and and On Golden Pond was sort of an anomaly.
Right.
That he didn't make a career in the 70s of playing a villain. Yeah. Oh my God, is he good.
Yeah.
Definitely. Rent. Steal. Rustle some cattle as a distraction.
It was on Netflix Instant for a long time. I don't know that it still is, but you would want to check if you've never seen it, because you really owe it to yourself to see both of these movies. But I think more so than Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I think Once Upon a Time in the West.
Dear Netflix, once you've added a film, don't remove it.
Right?
And how it's about making a list available? When I was doing those Better Yet lists, I came to terms with the fact that they don't really like anyone having a list.
I think there's some third-party sites that sort of aggregate everything that's on there.
But it's always changing.
Sure.
I get the feeling they want you to get on your laptop and sort of browse and then find something, and then you're happy, and they don't have to do that. But
a movie that I want to mention real quick as sort of an honorable mention, I didn't put it on my list, but in 2008, I think, Korean director Kim Ji-woon, who I've talked about before, did basically a remake of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly called The Good, the Bad, the Weird, which I know is available on Netflix Instant, and it's an amazing movie.
And you and Mike have talked about it.
Possibly, yes.
What have you seen lately in the previous podcast?
It's a great, great movie. So if you're a fan of one, you should see the other. Anyway.
Which leads to your next film.
My next film, also an Italian Western from the 60s, a spaghetti Western, if you will, and that is Sergio Corbucci's Django, a true sort of... it's very Italian. Franco Nero plays Django, the mysterious man who rides into town dragging a coffin with him, and they don't reveal until the end of the movie what is in the coffin.
Kept me watching.
To see the movie is to see how much that movie has been ripped off by specifically Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, who are clearly big fans of that movie.
Well, I was just going to say, anyone who listens to this podcast has to run right out and see it in anticipation of, I know, the film I'm most looking forward to.
Yeah, right.
Django Unchained,
yes,
which is coming out...
Christmas, I believe.
Yeah. Somehow I think of all of his films coming out in the summer. But
yeah. It's a great, great movie. And again, it's one of these Westerns that sort of separates the men from the boys, because... You have to get past the dubbing, you have to get past the performances, you have to get past sort of the violence, which is extreme, especially for the time, but also very silly looking by today's standards.
Yeah. The stylization of it. You sort of have to see within it to look at what it's really... What business is this film going about?
It's a great, great, great movie. And one that really holds up because of the way that things have sort of come back around, and now you have a generation of filmmakers who are inspired by these kinds of movies and constantly paying tribute to them. And so I think some contemporary audiences are almost more ready for some of these spaghetti Westerns than maybe an audience was in the 1980s. They've been primed a little bit more by seeing them regurgitated through other filmmakers.
Certainly a modern audience at the Alamo Drafthouse. Okay, chapter 4. There was a moment when Sean's mind was almost blank. It was reeling under shock and horror. Catsfoot's voice steadied him. Catsfoot had moved to the outer edge of the boardwalk. His arms were hanging easily at his sides. His eyes never left Guthrie as he said to Mrs. Heppel, "Have you been harmed, ma'am?" And I have a feeling that my next choice will raise Patrick's blood pressure and make him raise an argument. And I thought long and hard about this. I guess this is my sentimental choice.
Okay.
Because I understand it's a little hard to justify, given that this pushed 100 films out of one of the slots on this list. And it's Tombstone.
Yes.
Directed by George Cosmatos, or was it? Yeah. Because a couple years ago...
We've never gotten the full story on that. Well, I would love to know.
But we sort of have.
Okay.
Cosmatos passed away.
Right.
And Kurt Russell said, "I directed it."
Yeah.
I agreed to wait until he was gone, but something happened, yeah. And I don't think he was fired. I think he was incapable of continuing, and Tombstone was directed by Kurt Russell. So there.
Yeah, which should make me love it, because I love Kurt Russell. Here's the thing, and I'm kind of a hypocrite, because JB told me that that might be one of his choices, and I thought...
And he raised an eyebrow.
Really? Because Tombstone is one of these movies. I've seen it a bunch, because I think it's in a constant loop on TNT.
It is.
It's unbelievable. Tombstone is one of these movies that people really love. They think it's great. And I don't. I don't think it's great. I think it's kind of bad. However, and here's where I'm a hypocrite, more than a lot of Westerns, and specifically more than a lot of Westerns made in the last 30 years, and there's only a handful. Every couple of years they try and bring it back, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I will watch Tombstone. Like, I find it very watchable. I enjoy watching it, even though I don't really like it.
And that's why TNT has it on an endless loop, because like other films we've talked about on the podcast, it is infinitely rewatchable.
Yes.
I can do without the Dana Delaney nonsense.
Yikes.
I can certainly do without the Billy Zane nonsense. But it's Russell's performance.
Yeah.
A lot of the details of the Old West that you don't see in other films, like the Pharaoh game that they bankroll in the bar, getting to see Billy Bob Thornton back when he was fat.
The movie's amazing, if for no other reason. To watch it in 2012, almost to a person, every cast member in that movie is somebody. Some character actor that you recognize, somebody, Thomas Hayden Church before he was anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in that movie is somebody that you know.
And Stephen Lang is one of the bad guys.
Yeah.
And Stephen Lang has done such interesting work in such... He'll go away for years. Maybe he does Broadway or something.
I don't know.
Because my first exposure to Stephen Lang was he was Happy in the Dustin Hoffman Death of a Salesman.
Oh, okay.
And then he goes away for a while.
My first exposure was as the Party Crasher in The Hard Way.
Wow.
With Michael J. Fox and James Woods.
Wow.
Yeah.
Deep cut. And he shows up in Tombstone, I mean, looking completely... He's very good at transforming himself physically, and he's a real good bad guy. And then he goes away for a while, and then he's back in Avatar.
Yeah.
So go figure. The main reason that Tombstone is on the list is that goddamn Val Kilmer performance.
Yeah, 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 and that's the thing that...
It certainly belongs in a better film, but talk about approaching this from a different angle.
Yeah.
And I would guess doing some research on the actual character and saying, well, if he had this affliction, maybe that would lead to this. And after you see the film, you're almost required to do your Val Kilmer impression. When it was first released, people would leave the theater and turn to each other, "I'll be your Huckleberry."
Yeah, yeah.
And for the longest time, I thought he was saying Huckleberry.
He wasn't?
No, he's not. Oh, I can teach you something.
Oh, yay.
That I thought, as a joke, he was like trying to feminize someone by calling them a huckleberry, as if that's a thing.
I've always thought that's what he said.
He's saying hucklebearer.
Oh.
Huckle's a coffin. So when someone challenges him, "I'll be your huckleberry," which means I'm going to be the pallbearer at your funeral.
Got it.
S.O.B.
That's different.
And I can't remember, but he has several little bon mots throughout the film, but after a particular bad verbal showdown with the bad guys, he says something like, well, I don't think you're my friend anymore. I mean, it's just it's really a wonderful understatement. And even physically, the way he transforms himself, yeah. and certainly part of that is yeah. the makeup, just yeah. by the end of the film,
he's great, but again, the movie's a lot of funny mustaches and a lot of shootouts, which is fun in a Western. I actually kind of like, and I haven't seen it in a long time, the Lawrence Kasdan Wyatt Earp that came out, yeah. I think the same year, and it was one of those deep impact Armageddon situations where it just so happens that these two very similar movies come out at the same time. The Kasdan movie is a lot longer, a lot slower. Tombstone is more like the greatest hits. And is no matter how much I like the Lawrence Kasdan movie, it always falls short anytime Dennis Quaid is on screen mm-hmm. because you can't help but compare him to Val Kilmer.
That's a good point. Obviously, there's a whole boatload of films that revolve around what happened at the OK Corral,
right.
like Gunfight at the OK Corral. But that's sort of the centerpiece of this film.
Yeah.
And you can argue that the sides of it are a little lengthy.
Right.
That sequence is really well done, I yeah. think, and from what I've been told, a little bit more historically accurate. A couple years ago, we took a family vacation to Tucson mm-hmm. and visited old Tucson studios where boatloads of Westerns have actually been filmed,
yeah.
and it's a tourist attraction now, and it's kind of commercialized and stuff, but about half of Tombstone was filmed there. It's pretty cool.
My favorite scene in Tombstone is where Kurt Russell resists death by sheer force of will. He just says no over and over and walks straight into a barrage of gunfire and is never shot because he says no.
Well,
because
he's Kurt Russell.
My next movie is a little bit of a cheat, but I would still call this a Western from 1971. McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
No. Actually, like I said, I looked at all these lists. It's official. Everyone considers a Western.
Okay.
Although, oddly enough, very much outside this sort of iconic trope that right. I'm talking about, but what you yourself have dubbed a revisionist Western.
Yes.
That Robert Altman is looking at the Western, and much like he did his take on film noir with The Long Goodbye,
right.
that he's doing his...
Which is another movie I love.
No, that's terrific. That this is his take on the Western.
Right. It's not so much about guys on horses shooting at each other, although there's a little bit of that, as it is about sort of the construction of America. And
what happens when we start a town.
Right. And it's an unbelievably great movie. Just one of the saddest, loneliest movies you will ever see in your life. Warren Beatty is great. The Leonard Cohen songs are great. The photography is great.
I was going to say, the closest a film has ever come to visually looking elegiac.
Yeah.
The things he did. Oddly enough, when that film was first released, people had problems with the sound mix.
Right.
Even Warren Beatty, apparently.
Because that was kind of the first time he did that crazy overlapping.
Was Fit to be Tied. And yeah. I've actually read that he went back and tweaked it for the first DVD release.
Really?
So you're listening to something a little different.
Interesting that Beatty would object to the sound mix when he mumbles all of his dialogue.
Well, I think perhaps, and I can't speak for Warren Beatty, God knows, Annette Bening does just fine by that. But that Beatty felt that that was a natural performance, and it was the director's job to get that on the screen in a way that people could audibly understand.
Sure.
But I remember reading when that film came out, people were really scratching their heads because they couldn't decipher the dialogue.
Yeah. When I first kind of got into Robert Altman movies, that was one that I hadn't really even heard of, and that was probably because I was kind of young, and so I tracked it down and found it and was just blown away by how good it is. I don't know.
I love Robert Altman.
Yeah.
I miss him. He lived so long, and at the end of his life, I mean, he's putting out Gosford Park, and it's right. like...
I mean, he made so many really terrible movies, too, but the highs are so high that you can forgive...
I would argue with some of the terrible ones.
Okay.
There's parts of Popeye I really like.
I don't even include Popeye on that list. I actually kind
of
like Popeye.
Are a hot mess.
Yeah.
Health, I could do without... that odd Paul Newman film, Quintet, Quartet,
yes,
Foxtrot,
yes,
whatever that was called.
Yeah.
But
Beyond Therapy?
Oh, I forgot about that. That if you look at it through the lens that he knew it would be his last film, Prairie Home Companion is really interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Through that lens.
Right. Do you know they had Paul Thomas Anderson like on standby for that whole movie?
I've read that.
Yeah.
But part of that might be that I actually used to listen to that radio show.
Sure.
Saturday evenings, and I used to kind of enjoy it in a guilty pleasure type of way.
Yeah.
I'm up?
Yeah.
Okay. My next film is The Wild Bunch.
Yes. Another movie that probably would have been on my list.
Crazy Sam Peckinpah, and much like films like Psycho and Some Like It Hot, I show it every semester in film study class, so I see it over and over and over. And every time I see it, I see something new in it. Of course, there's that iconic thing at the beginning where he keeps freezing the frame mm-hmm. and it goes to sepia. And it's clear at the end that he's done all of that for 5 minutes just so that we can have William Holden saying, "If they move, kill them." Directed by Sam Peckinpah. And some people thought Tarantino borrowed that at the end of Inglourious Basterds. I think this is my masterpiece, yeah. directed by
right, him. Right, right, right.
But when you read about Sam Peckinpah's career and how often the film was taken away from him and some of his personal demons and things, and how one critic suggested that he just kept making the same film over and over until they would let him do it mm-hmm. because Major Dundee has some things in common with The Wild Bunch. That's interesting too, but I think mainly because there's actors in The Wild Bunch that I have tremendous personal affection for, mostly William Holden and Ernest Borgnine. And in the film, as Hollywood actors, they're getting older, and clearly the theme of the film is the jig's up, guys.
Right.
There's no more West. There's no more Frontier. Oh, look, there's a car. Have you seen? And I heard they have a flying machine. And it's interesting when my students watch the film, because I think they consider every Western to sort of be made in this timeless bubble
right,
of the
right,
West.
Right.
And the minute the car pulls into that town, suddenly they have something very specific to say, oh, it's 1910, it's 1915?
That these two things are going on at the same time.
Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. And then there's other historical signifiers like mm-hmm. Pancho Villa and some other things and right. the Germans that... From your definition, this is not a square Western. This is very definitely a revisionist Western.
Yeah.
Where, in keeping with films like The Dirty Dozen in the late 60s, we are so bereft of a moral compass that our heroes are, by any definition, despicable.
Right.
Although, as the film goes on, they certainly adhere to a stronger code than the supposed good guys. At one point, there's an argument about whether... there's a big bunch of bad men who ride together, and Robert Ryan used to be one of them, and he's been arrested, and he's been forced to track his former compatriots down. And at one point, Holden and Borgnine have this argument about whether he's a turncoat, mm-hmm. and it all centers on he gave his word. He gave his word. And at another point, they say, if you can't stick with a man, you're no better than an animal. So there is this sort of code
right.
at work there. And The Wild Bunch is amazing. What's that definition I keep throwing out? Three great scenes, no bad scenes.
Right.
The blowing up of the bridge.
Yeah.
That amazing bank robbery gone bad at the beginning
yeah.
that in any other film would be the climax
right.
of the film.
Right.
And my students very much... see my point when I say, by starting the film with that, Peckinpah is sort of teasing you throughout the rest of the film. Yeah, I've got something at the end that's... I still think it's one of the most violent scenes
sure.
ever filmed
sure.
in an American film. But again, I don't think it's eye candy. I don't think it's for titillation. I actually think Peckinpah is saying something about violence.
He made a lot of Westerns. I think The Wild Bunch is the best among them. There were two other movies that I considered putting on the list, both Peckinpah movies, The Ballad of Cable Hogue,
yeah.
which isn't necessarily a traditional Western, but is great and has a great, great Jason Robards performance. And actually, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which is a movie I've only seen the sort of the restoration. I never saw the version that played in theaters that was taken away from him. But I think it's a great movie and one that deserves to be sort of rediscovered. But The Wild Bunch puts them all to shame, obviously. And The Wild Bunch is interesting because every couple of decades we get, you know, The Wild Bunch really came at the end of Westerns, the Western movement. By the 70s, they were making some, especially Clint Eastwood was still doing Outlaw Josie Wales, and he was making Westerns. But The Wild Bunch theoretically could have been the last Western, that this movie has sort of the last word on Westerns.
Yeah.
And then two decades pass, and then we have that again with Unforgiven, that, okay, Unforgiven now kind of, that's the last Western.
That's the nail in the coffin.
Right. And then we still get a few more trickling out over the next couple of years, and I'm wondering if we'll get another movie that will be the last Western. I don't think we can, because Peckinpah came at the end of the Western. The reason that people say that about Clint Eastwood is because it's the end of the Clint Eastwood Western. We don't have anybody else that we identify with Westerns the way we did
with Clint Eastwood. And I've heard some people advance that theory, that every couple years they try to revive the Western. No. Every couple years, Clint Eastwood makes another film. which I really think is the case. It's interesting. A couple years back, they went... And now I'm thinking it's more than a couple of years, because I'm getting on. They went back and they restored The Wild Bunch. They found some stuff, and they put it back to its roadshow length, and it actually got theatrical distribution. It played at Piper's Alley.
That was the first time I saw it.
And I went to
Piper's Alley
and
see it.
With the intermission, and it was really, really great.
That was my first time seeing it.
They ran into an interesting problem, because in the late 60s, it was rated R. And they did the restoration, and what they put back was not more sex and violence.
Right.
It was mostly backstory on how Robert Ryan came to be apprehended, and they had to resubmit it to the MPAA, where it promptly got an NC-17.
Yeah.
So I was in this position where I could no longer show it in class, because I get parents' permission for the R-rated films. But NC-17, I don't think that's going
to
fly.
Tough to swing, yeah.
I've heard it has since been overturned.
Downgraded, yeah. And honestly, I think, because I might have been in high school when that came out, and I probably, I can't
So it
imagine.
Was more than a couple of years
ago. It was a long time ago. I don't think I knew much about Sam Peckinpah at the time. Honestly, what might have attracted me to it was like, oh, that's a movie that got an X rating for violence. Like, I want to see that. That's what drew me to it.
And there's an interesting subtext running through The Wild Bunch, and some people would even say it's not a subtext because it's so blatantly obvious. At the beginning of the film, we see the bad guys roll by, and there's some children playing a game. And during the botched robbery, they have to ride past the children again, and we realize the children have ants and a scorpion, and they're throwing a scorpion on top of an anthill to watch the ants attack the scorpion. And then at the end, they set fire to the whole thing, so they're basically torturing animals. Or insect. During the entire film, there's this interesting observation made about what children see. In the Mexican Pueblo scene, the children are very aware of the outlaws and watching them. And throughout the film, there's all this evidence of that. And in the scene where they visit the one member's town, there's this old man who sort of waxes nostalgic and knowledgeable. And he says something like, "We all long to go back to when we were children, perhaps the wicked among us most of all." And it really shows that Peckinpah was aware of this film working on many levels, and there's a whole lot more going on in the film than just bank robbers. Caveat, one thing, the only criticism I've made of The Wild Bunch, and this also appears in Danny Perry's book, Cult Movies, every so often, the film strains to show us camaraderie between the men, and it never works.
Yeah.
And someone should have done another pass on the screenplay. Something happens, and they all start laughing like idiots.
Well, that's so we could get the shots at the end, right?
Which I still don't understand why they did that.
Yeah, it's very much out of place with what has come before it.
I much prefer the final shot. We go back to them leaving the Mexican village. Mm-hmm. And the picture gets smaller and smaller, that Peckinpah is trying to say something about male bonding. The first time is Ernest Borgnine makes a joke about the Tector, the Gorch brothers running whores. Mm-hmm. And it's some sort of weird pun, and they all start laughing. And then later there's that scene where they share the bottle of whiskey, and they share it in a way that when the bottle gets passed to Warren Oates, it's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And their laughter is so out of proportion or, you know, maybe they're star for entertainment out on the prairie or something. The camaraderie stuff doesn't work at all, yeah. And that's a problem.
Do you have one more?
Yeah.
Okay, as do I. So I will go. My last and most recent pick is from 2007, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which I think has a lot in common with some of these revisionist Westerns that we're talking about, that it's sort of about the death of the West, the death of these legends that we've built up, the death of sort of an American myth.
The death of a certain way of approaching life, and certainly the film suggests that the Robert Ford.
Casey Affleck.
That the Casey Affleck character is our modern man.
Sort of, yeah.
And he's clearly shown to be wanting.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how much I loved that film when it came out.
Yeah.
And was convinced that I could never get anyone to see it.
Yeah.
Because if you want to talk about a glacial pace, that is a film that takes its time.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things I loved about it.
Absolutely, because again, it's deliberate and it's rewarding, and it's not as though it's boring.
No.
Because a movie can be slow and entirely captivating. And this movie is, again, another movie that's populated by a ton of great actors and character actors, including Jeremy Renner a couple years before anybody knew his name, and Garrett Dillahunt a couple years before anybody knew his name. A really good Brad Pitt performance, an unbelievable Casey Affleck performance. Roger Deakins' cinematography, I'm convinced, would have won all of the Oscars, but I believe No Country for Old Men came out the same year. And it's interesting that overshadowed Jesse James so much, because Jesse James basically was a total bomb at the box office. I'm hoping that it's a movie that continues to get rediscovered, because I feel like the people that have seen it all really like it. So I hope its reputation only continues to grow, because I think it's a masterpiece.
And this came up in the comments section on the blog when I was talking about how awful the Oscars were and how they never get it right. That the year that you're talking about, it was, There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men. There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men. Well, no, how about The Assassination of...
Right.
That it really got undeservedly ignored. And good Lord, I love that film. Who directed that?
Andrew Dominik, who has not made a movie since. That was his second movie. He made a movie called Chopper, about an Australian serial killer with Eric Bana.
Okay.
And then Assassination of Jesse James, and that put him in movie jail for a couple of years. He finally has a movie coming out, I believe, later this year, again with Brad Pitt, about a mob enforcer. And the title just changed, and I don't remember what the title is.
Hmm.
But I'm excited that he has another movie coming out.
I love that film. I'm glad it's on your list.
Yep.
And finally, my favorite Western, and I don't think I'm alone, is The Searchers, the quintessential John Ford Western. It's the first Western I show in my film study class. I know that very often my students don't know what to suspect, and they're a little trepidatious, and they think they're going to be bored by it, or they know nothing about Westerns and don't know what to expect. I cannot describe to you the atmosphere in my classroom when I show The Searchers. And I'd like to think that even though I'm a fuddy-duddy, I'm still capable of gauging the mood of the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's like church. They're so into it.
Yeah.
And it's so different than what they expected.
Yeah.
I think they're expecting X. And what they get is, oh, I don't know if I like John Wayne.
Right.
John Wayne might be crazy, or at least a crazy racist.
Yeah. Do you think in any way that, again, because we went through the 70s where the protagonist of movies changed completely, that everything has changed so much that, like I said about Django, sort of that audiences now are much more primed to understand or accept what The Searchers has to offer. I don't know, because I wasn't alive. Searchers came out, what, 57?
I believe it's 56.
That movie had to knock people on their asses in 57, because, again, you had John Wayne.
Yes, but I think to a certain extent,
who was always John Wayne, and now he's, what is this?
But I think that actually kept people from seeing what it was.
Really?
Because they just assumed it was another one.
Really?
And didn't again, I'm just pontificating. I think the mistake my students make, though, is thinking that John Wayne is the protagonist. And I don't think he is. I think if you look at the film, it's Marty's story.
Right.
And what this film is about a character who starts one way, and through the process of the plot and the course of the film, we see him grow up and become someone really admirable. Because it's him at the end who figures out what's on John Wayne's mind. And it's him at the end who says, John Wayne gives some bizarre Byzantine excuse for doing what he's about to do. Spoiler alert, he's going to shoot Natalie Wood through the head. And Marty says, no, that's not the right way to look at it at all. That has nothing to do. Oh, John Wayne says,
what you need to do is drown her.
John Wayne says, I never told you this, but Indians killed your parents. Yeah. And he correctly says, that has nothing to do with this. But in the spirit of an old school Hollywood film, this is very much a square Western, all the trappings aside, there are a few moments more satisfying and certainly more sentimental than when John Wayne picks up Natalie Wood at the end and says, let's go home, Debbie, which is sort of amazing. And talk about films that have been ripped off.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways. And probably the most famous is Taxi Driver, which Martin Scorsese.
You can call him Marty, it's fine.
Well, because there's a character in Searchers called Marty. Martin Scorsese will cheerfully tell you that Taxi Driver is his version of the Searchers.
Right.
And Travis Bickle is Ethan Edwards, and Natalie Wood is Jodie Foster, and they even called Matthew Scar because he's the Scar figure. Mm-hmm. And Scorsese said they added the scene where Harvey Keitel sort of seduces Jodie Foster. You're my woman and I need my woman. Because Scorsese always thought there was a scene missing in The Searchers between Scar and the Natalie Wood character to show why she stays.
Right.
But of course, in 50s Hollywood, that was less important. Wonderful color cinematography. Wonderful music. I don't think Monument Valley has ever looked that good, and John Ford was no stranger to Monument Valley. It is the quintessential Western. I think it's the best Western ever made.
I think even if you are somebody who has been resistant to Westerns in the past, who just says, I don't want to watch people in hats ride horses. And that's fine. They're not for everyone, although your former professor would disagree. There are a few exceptions. I wouldn't include, like, Django on this list. But I think you could watch these 10 movies, whether you like Westerns or not, and understand their greatness.
And use them as a roadmap. And if you really respond to The Searchers, seek out more John Ford.
Yeah.
Although, you should seek out more John Ford anyway. And Rio Bravo is a great introduction to Howard Hawks, who worked in lots of other genres.
Right. But always made the same movie, sort of, about
the bonds
between men. And
men who are very good at their jobs.
Right.
So these 9 films without that Django thing
and Star Wars, please.
It's a Western.
I know. I agree.
That it could be sort of a roadmap, for you to start watching Westerns.
Yeah. 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 Do you want to finish with this?
Yes. Cause I know everyone's on their edge of their seat. So once again, this is Chapter 6, Guntown Marshall. Sean leapt from the saddle as he reined in. Vaguely, he was aware of the hideously painted faces which looked blankly at him. Faintly, the acrid smell of Apache bodies was in his nostrils.
Sounds like Christmas.
At your house.